The Lord be with you.
And with your
A reading from the Holy Gospel according to Luke. On a Sabbath, Jesus went to dine at the home of one of the leading Pharisees, and the people were observing him carefully. He told a parable to those who had been invited, noticing how they were choosing the places of honor at the table. When you are invited by someone to a wedding banquet, do not recline at table in the place of honor. A more distinguished guest than you may have been invited by him, and the host who invited both of you may approach you and say, "Give your place to this man." And then you would proceed with embarrassment to take the lowest place. Rather, when you are invited, go and take the lowest place so that when the host comes to you, he may say, "My friend, move up to a higher position." Then you will enjoy the esteem of your companions at the table. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but the one who humbles himself will be exalted. Then he said to the host who invited him, "When you hold a lunch or a dinner, do not invite your friends or your brothers or your relatives or your wealthy neighbors, in case they may invite you back and you have repayment. Rather, when you hold a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind. Blessed indeed will you be because of their inability to repay you, for you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous." The Gospel of the Lord. What is the major difference between the Old Testament and the New Testament? The two pictures painted for us today by the writer of the letter to the Hebrews tells us. One picture is of Mount Sinai, where God gave his law to the people of Israel through Moses, with Mount Sinai functioning as a symbol of the entire Old Testament. The other picture is of Mount Zion, where Jerusalem was located. This was a symbol of heaven, of the city of believers that have entered into communion with God, not through fearful obedience to God's strict laws, but through loving obedience to the Messiah, Jesus Christ. These are the members of the New Testament. The Old and New Testaments are both covenants, solemn, committed relationships freely entered into. The relationship in both cases is between God and his chosen people, between God and those who believe in him. This relationship gradually matured as God revealed himself more and more from the beginning of the Old Testament until the establishment of the New. These two pictures, therefore, can give us a good idea of the difference between an immature and a mature relationship with God. In the Old Covenant, people had an incomplete notion of who God is. And as a result, their relationship with him was immature, not wrong, just immature. And the predominant characteristic of that relationship was fear. In those times, people were much more aware than they are today of the severity and seriousness of sin and the punishment that sin, rebellion against God, truly deserved. They were also more aware of their own sinfulness. This double awareness inspired fear, since God hated sin, and they were astutely aware of their own sinfulness and that they were sinners. This is the attitude the letter to the Hebrews calls to mind when it describes the experience that the ancient Israelites had of receiving God's law on Mount Sinai. They were so intimidated by God's holiness that they begged that no message be further addressed to them. The book of Exodus even tells us that if an animal, like a cow, a sheep, or a goat, touched the mountainside while God was giving Moses the Ten Commandments, it had to be stoned. Moses himself described the experience of being in God's presence by saying that he was utterly terrified and trembling. God was holy. Mankind was sinful, and that created a tension, to say the least. So as you can see, this was long before pseudo-psychology kind of came along and convinced us that sin is just an emotional malfunction, that we're not really responsible for our self-centered and destructive actions, which, of course, we all know is a lie. But fear was not the only characteristic of the chosen people's relationship with God in the Old Testament. In those times, people were also keenly aware of God's majesty, much more than we tend to be today. They still saw wonder and magnificence in the world around them, and they knew clearly that the creator of such a world had to be even more wonderful and magnificent. We see this in the description of Mount Sinai as being cloaked in blazing fire and gloomy darkness and storm and a trumpet blast. Here is a God who is not only holy, but mysterious and transcendent and immensely powerful. And so, the Israelites were full of awe when they thought of God and when they entered into his presence through prayer and worship. This was also long before our modern technological revolution had created the comfortable illusion that the physical universe is just a toy that man can use or abuse, casting awe aside as a relic of the unenlightened past. It was long before the modern world started putting religious faith in human science, all the while laughing at those who kept religious faith in God. The fear and awe that characterized the Old Testament view of God was, again, not wrong, but it was incomplete. God still seemed so far away that man was suspicious of God. But God didn't want to keep us at a distance. When in his wisdom he saw that the time is right, he threw a bridge over the abyss that kept man and God so far apart. That bridge was God becoming man in Jesus Christ, the incarnation. Christ is the bridge that draws sinful man back into intimacy with God. He shed his blood to atone for our sins, showing that God's mercy can release us from fear. And he rose from the dead to prove that in him we don't have to just admire God's majesty from a distance, but we can actually enter into it through our friendship with Christ and enjoy it from the inside. This is what we see in the picture of Mount Zion as the heavenly Jerusalem. It shows us a city where God is present and surrounded by immense crowds. His angels are at his side, and all the men and women who have been faithful to him make up the assembly of the firstborn. In other words, each has been welcomed and honored by God as his very own child. This is what Christ has won for us: closeness to God through life of grace, joyful intimacy with the creator of the universe, healthy fear turned into confident love, and frightening awe transformed into indescribable delight. This is the picture being painted for us today in the letter to the Hebrews, the stark contrast between a mature and an immature relationship with God. As Christians, each one of us, no matter our age, is called to live in a mature relationship with God. We're not strangers to God as at Mount Sinai, but members of his household called to live in a relationship of closeness and confidence as on Mount Zion. So the question is that how we're living? So just as a quick checkup, let's measure our spiritual maturity by looking at some of our Christian vital signs, if you will. First, there's confession. The immature Christian stays far away from confession. For him, or her for that matter, confession is like the thunderous mountaintop. It only inspires fear. But for the mature Christian, confession is an intimate conversation with the Lord who never gets tired of forgiving. It's a joyful embrace, a coming home again like the prodigal son. And it's an opportunity to begin again. Second, there's morality. The immature Christian sees following the moral teachings of Christ and the church as a burden. It's like following a list of random and inconvenient rules. But for the mature Christian, following Christ is a meaningful, joyful mission. It can be difficult, absolutely, but so can many other things in life that are worthwhile. Finally, there's prayer and worship, which falls under the virtue of justice, giving to God what is due to him. The immature Christian prays out of obligation or with mindless disinterest. Prayer is boring. They don't get anything out of it. And similarly, the immature Christian extends that same sentiment to attendance at Sunday Mass and holy days of obligation. And prayer eventually and worship give way to more important things. But the mature Christian sees prayer and worship as vital and non-negotiable. His motivation to prayer and worship, regardless of how he feels at that moment, is love for who God is, not what he may or may not get out of it. The difference being an attitude of love rather than the modern consumerist mentality of God as a divine vending machine. If this checkup has shown that there's room for improvement in our Christian maturity, let us ask God in this Mass to grant us the necessary graces needed to open our minds and our hearts to see him as he really is, our loving and faithful Father.